Welcome to the Theology Upstream podcast, a podcast sponsored by Myers Park Baptist Church, a church that is bold in spirit and open to all. We are two young clergy people tackling theological concepts by engaging relevant books with a theological imagination, working to make theology accessible for a broader audience and connecting it with daily spiritual practices. We also need to confess that we are hopelessly optimistic that the church still has something relevant to say to people who live their lives in today's world. Hello, hello, and welcome back. This is Chrissy and Ben here with our final episode of Theology Upstream, book for a little while. The future of TU is to be determined.
Yes.
But we wanted you to know we're starting one book for the season of Advent called Incarnate, the Body of Christ in an Age of Disengagement.
Yes. We're very excited about jumping into this book, but before we do, for all of those of you who are still in your feelings about Chrissy's departure, I am still in my feelings about it as well. And even though this podcast is really her brainchild, and we are so grateful to Chrissy for having created it, we hope that even though we will take a pause from Theology Upstream, that we'll be able to engage in some new podcast work in 2019. With some new guests on it, I'll do my best. I'm not going to be able to create the magic that Chrissy and I have had on this podcast.
There will be new magic.
We'll create some new magic.
Yes.
And we will send Chrissy off to do new things and hopefully do some more podcasting together in the future.
Absolutely. So we wanted to let you know before we get started with this book that you can find the episodes for this book soon. Coming soon on iTunes under the name Awakening Shalom Podcast, and that's the new podcast channel where you'll be able to experience the new magic.
That's right.
While Theology Upstream is on pause.
Take a little pause from that one and give birth to a new podcast at the same time.
In the season of Advent.
Yeah, that's right.
Why not?
Perfect timing. Yes. Someone was born around this time.
Who was that?
Not yet, though, all of you listening to Christmas music in your cars after you turn this podcast off. Not yet. Hold on. Can you wait in the season of waiting? Can you anticipate and expect and prepare? That's what we're going to try to do. Is we're diving into this book, Incarnate, in the season where we are awaiting the incarnation. Not always here yet, already here yet, but leaning into and intentionally waiting for Jesus to be born again, for the incarnation to happen, and talking about what does incarnation mean. And really diving in this year of the body that we're in, continuing to move into discussions about the body and faith and how they engage each other.
Yeah, and in some ways I feel like this book was written for this series because it's all about reminding us of our flesh.
Yep.
And, you know, we're going to talk about the introduction in chapter one a little bit today and the movement of kind of defleshment. The defleshing of the human experience, as Michael Frost, the author, names it in the introduction.
Yes.
And I think it's really cool that we're talking about this book and this series and this Advent using a digital medium.
Well, we do have to give that disclaimer, don't we? That we are, in fact, engaging in disembodied technology to bring you a discussion about how to be embodied. So, you know, humor us with this irony.
Yeah.
That here we are coming to you through your headphones or through your car stereo or through however you're listening to us, and we're not actually with you in person.
That's
but
right.
We hope this is simply a supplement for a larger body series that involves your body showing up at church for formation opportunities and being present and engaging in all the bodily practices that a Christian community is, fellowship, eating, talking, conversation, worship, all the body things that we do. So as we dive into this defleshed discussion, we hope that you'll humor us on that road and find your own ways to embody this book
exactly.
In your life. Some of you looking at your phones thinking, this thing might be trying to kill me.
I know. I'm imagining Chrissy and Ben as like two disembodied voices that
yes.
are coming out of like right and left speaker.
We are just talking heads now, Chrissy. We've been doing this so long.
I feel like we need to have the associated bobbleheads.
Yeah, we should. Somebody should make bobbleheads of us. Somebody already made socks with my head on them. So I think it's about time
for
bobbleheads.
To any of you three listeners
that
out there.
That sounds like a challenge for your departure party. To see if I can find a bobblehead of you between now and then.
I don't think it exists.
It's going to be one of you shining so brightly.
I cannot be objectified in such a way.
Oh, my God. Don't steal all of our thunder just yet. Here's one of the most disgusting things ever is this description of the practice of defleshing a human skeleton that was a popular practice in certain cultures as a way of basically getting their bones to the right place and not allowing the body to be destroyed or disrespected, disturbed by vultures and other carrion and animals tearing at flesh. And so they just go ahead and deflesh the whole body so that the bones can be buried without being disturbed. And, talking about it in relationship to certain different tribes and communities. And he uses that as an example to get at what the word excarnate, which is he's going to be his sort of foil throughout the whole book as the opposite of what incarnate feels like and looks like. And he uses that to kind of say that to sort of create a lens through which to look at all the ways that contemporary society has been defleshed.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really gross metaphor.
It's pretty visual.
I'm reading the book for the first time. I'm like, ooh.
It's pretty, it's disgusting.
It's pretty gross.
Yeah.
But to his point, it's exactly what we're doing to ourselves without realizing it. Mm-hmm. He's got a lot of really visceral examples to prove his point, which I think is appropriate.
Yeah.
Because we should feel it in our bodies and get out of our heads a little bit.
And it would be bad enough if it was just our social existence that was defleshed or disembodied or excarnate. It would be bad enough if it was just our morality, but it is in fact our faith. Mm-hmm. And he tries to make the argument, maybe not as convincing as some others with historical data, that in fact our faith has helped contribute to the fact that we have gotten into this excarnate place.
Oh, for
the
sure.
very duality that you and I have been talking about for what feels like 6 months, a year now. Mm-hmm. Is what got us to this place where we could imagine a disconnect between our imagination and our flesh or our bodies and our souls and what led us into this place.
Yeah, I'm kind of hopping around in his work just between introduction and chapter one. On page 26, to your point, he says, he's quoting someone else, John Thompson, but he says of Christianity, of American Christianity in particular, that the church has been severely diminished due to a preoccupation with ideas and abstractions at the expense of such embodiment. Mm. And I wrote in my little on the side, theology of salvation. And I was just thinking back in my own life and the journey of theological education, how like the biggest hang up I had was not what do I do with my body, but it was, can I be a Christian if my salvation becomes more than just an idea? Mm. Like if salvation is more than just, did I say the prayer right? Did I have the belief right? You know, is it going to pass all these ideological litmus tests?
Right, right.
And anyway, so.
Which are kind of disembodied, right?
Oh, it's 100% disembodied. It has nothing to do with what happens with my body.
Yeah.
You know, and it goes back to that theology of the way that I learned it. Now this theology plays out differently for different people, but the once saved, always saved.
Yeah.
You know, if you say the right prayer, you believe the right things, then it doesn't matter what you do with your body for the rest of your life because you've been saved. Well, you know, I've learned in my own journey how to reappropriate that phrase, but the implications of that surface level, I've been saved because I believe the right things. And so what I do with my body doesn't matter.
Yes.
Has led to so much trauma and harm.
Yeah. And that's where he says that back on 13, where he's talking about how we are entirely in our heads. Mm-hmm. Almost all of the central human experiences are now taking place, not in our bodies, but in our heads now. And this is why it's so interesting the way we see stress in our society around politics, because politics now is also happening in our heads. Mm-hmm. It's really about what you think. You're right or left. Mm-hmm. And just like what you think is what makes you a religious person. Jesus has never said any of that. What makes you what you are is what you do.
Right.
You are what you do.
Right.
You know? And so like you can say all you want, Pharisee, Sadducee, et cetera, about how religious you are. In fact, you can even do some of the things that seem religious, but unless you're doing all the things, and particularly the things related to taking care of the poor and the oppressed, what you call yourself and what you think you are doesn't really matter.
That's right.
You know, it's all about what you actually live, how your life, what your body, where your body is located. mm-hmm. and what it's doing in relationship to the people that you are located near.
Right. Right. Well, and it harkens back to the quote from Descartes, right? I think, therefore I am. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, like we've kind of moved and then gone back to that as a society. And think about what that means for, to me, this is why we can't sit around a Thanksgiving table or a Christmas table and like respect the shared meal with people who just think differently.
Yeah.
And it's why we have the question of like, how am I going to spend an hour with my sister?
I know.
You know?
We have nothing to talk about.
Yeah, when in reality, like you have the whole, like you've got the whole thing to talk about.
You got everything to talk about.
Yeah,
right.
That's perfect because
I think that's also how we like church. This is one of the things James K. Smith tried to work with us about while we were here. Is that we're so like he kept using the metaphor brains on a stick.
Yeah.
That we have created worship experiences that appeal to you as brains on a stick. Mm-hmm. We are here to give you information for you to be a better thinker.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Or we're giving you information thinking that somehow that's going to change your behavior.
Right.
When everybody knows, you know who's not doing that? Advertisers.
Yeah.
They're not like,
right. They're worried about how you feel. What
that's
do you
right.
love? What
They're
do
not
you...
like, you know, this beer has just the right calories for you. And if you drink it, it's going to make you feel just right. Here's what's in it exactly. Here's what's in this beer. Right.
Get your head around
actually,
what that might taste
here's
like.
This beautiful person drinking that beer. And you want to be with that beautiful person. And it's going to make you feel like that.
Or
so easy.
Like local IPA.
Right.
That's good.
That's right.
Like it has nothing to do with my brain. It tastes good.
It tastes good.
You
that's
know?
Right. That's right.
It's
very
cold
bodily.
On a hot summer day.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
There's nothing. Yeah. So there's like the way we're appealing to people is getting – well, I think what we learned through that was that behavior is not shifted by thought.
Right.
Just by education, pure intellectual formation.
Right. Right.
Right? That we need fully embodied change to be change in behavior.
Well, I mean, so I criticized the kind of more conservative thought a minute ago, so I need to criticize the liberal thought now,
yeah,
which
go
is
at him,
like,
Chrissy.
I mean, as liberal thinkers are often stuck in our minds, like how different would the world be if everyone's ideas about equity and justice were lived out in bodies?
Right. Well, that's sometimes how the right always will come back at the left
that
and
is.
Say,
it's
like, yeah, you keep saying that, you elite person, you care about the poor. Mm-hmm. Really, you're just elite living in a million-dollar house being owned and paid for by banks and using the right social talking points.
And it's a fair critique.
Yeah, it's quite a very fair – in fact, the Democratic Party hasn't figured out how to deal with that yet. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's part of the problem right now is that a lot of the language on both sides seems very shallow. You know, one saying, I'm going to take care of you. You're my people. If you just vote for me. And then reality, it's about money. And the other saying, I'm going to take care of you. You're my people. And then it's really about money.
It is.
It's almost always about money. Both sides are saying, I'll take care of you. I'll protect you from those other bad guys.
Yep.
And I'll take care of you as my people. But in reality, they don't care about you at all.
Right. And when we are disembodied without limitation or without an arena in which we are forced to engage with our bodies, with literal skin in the game, then it doesn't matter if anything is deep because it's never put to the test.
That's amazing.
How about that? Like there's no common space that people have to get in and reckon with each other.
Right.
And when they do, it's self-selected from the ideological pools. So like you have tables where meals are had and people are talking, but they all disagree with one another.
Yeah.
Because if you don't agree, then you don't want to show up. I mean, seriously, church, and I think
that's what church is supposed to be.
Church is supposed to be that, but it's becoming this other thing. Maybe because everyone's listening to preachers on podcasts.
Everybody's just listening to podcasts instead of coming to church. What the heck? Are we helping this? What are we going to do to stop that, Chrissy?
Well.
A campaign. It's going to be a new campaign. It's called worship.
I was going to set it up better, man. I was going to say, like, maybe we should do this thing where, like, we come to the same room.
Yeah, everybody.
The same time every
stands
week.
Stands and sits next to each other, but all facing the same direction.
Yeah. And maybe there could be some really good music.
Yeah.
And maybe.
And they could, like, sway their bodies.
Yeah. And maybe at one point they could shake hands.
Or hug. Is that too much to ask?
It might be.
For some, yeah. I mean, we don't want to.
And then they could like get in the rhythm of doing these things and go out into the world. And on like Wednesday at 3, they might want to just do it in the office.
You mean pray?
Pray. Or shake hands.
Or shake hands.
Or like
hug. Or
say I'm sorry.
Confess their sins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it sounds like really crazy.
Or can you imagine somebody like in the middle of a work day, like just jumping up from their seat and singing the Gloria? Gloria, you know, I just think
Hold
it would
on,
be.
Keep singing.
No. I just think it would be so funny. Everybody around you would be like, what in the world?
I triple dog dare you to do that meeting tomorrow. Just like at like 10:17, just stand up and start singing the Gloria.
Just in the middle of staff meeting. And just see what people do. You think everybody else would stand? It's like the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, or the,
I don't know.
Or the Star Spangled Banner. Everybody else has to stand when one person starts singing it.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, as far as embodied practices go, yep. I still think that it would be interesting from a sort of church state, who's your loyalty really in perspective for Christians to put their hands over their hearts when they sing the doxology.
Mm. Well, that sounds subversive.
Yeah, it would be.
That's interesting. Okay, so talk more about that.
Well, because it would be because it's an embodied way of saying, because that's what we do when we sing the Star Spangled Banner.
Right.
And like if you don't take off your hat and you don't put your hand, or if you were to kneel, God forbid, act of protest, or if you were to sit in your seat and not actually sing it, you're going to become the, you know, so it is this pledge of loyalty that everyone has to do out of respect, but it's really pledging some kind of allegiance to the flag, to America, to American nationalism, to whatever, our wars, our history. And so in worship, you have this movement. If you were to replicate that or you were to do it more primarily for the doxology, like every week, because you only do it for the flag once in a while, but if you do it for the doxology every week, then you would be reminded of when you do it for the flag.
Right.
You would be reminded of that bodily movement that you do in worship for God. Mm-hmm. And it would remind you of what your real loyalty is.
I know. And in some ways it would feel, I think it would help us understand what it means to say Jesus Christ is Lord.
Yeah.
As opposed to Caesar as Lord.
Exactly.
Right?
Which is what a radical statement for the early church.
Yeah.
You know, and to refuse to bend the knee when they were being asked to, you know, pledge their loyalty to Caesar. Some were skinned alive.
Yeah.
Some were burned at the stake. They were defleshed. They were murdered.
Yeah.
But they were willing to actually lose their bodies for their faith, which seems so preposterous in the modern world now. Because we think faith is something all up here, we can't even imagine how a person could get martyred for their faith anymore.
I know. I remember having that thought as a child, like, because you learn a lot about religious persecution, like as an idea.
Evangelicals do. Nobody else does.
Well, growing up, I learned a lot
about...
The
Mennonites and the evangelicals are reading the Martyr's Mirror and Fox's Book of Martyrs. Yeah,
I actually did read that.
I did too. Yeah. I had the Jesus Freak DC Talk version.
The Jesus Freak Bible?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
And there's a DC Talk version of the Martyrs thing, yeah.
Whew, it's amazing we turned out as well as we did.
Look at us.
Look at us now. Disembodied
Just
voices
from
on a podcast.
Small town in Cabarrus County.
Excuse me, I'm from Charlotte.
Okay, yeah, you keep telling yourself that.
I may have gone to high school in Cabarrus County.
You're going to need to start saying Concord.
I was born at Presbyterian Hospital.
Okay, yeah.
Anyway.
That's like when I was from Lynchburg, but was born in Richmond, because there was no hospital for like 2 hours.
Okay.
Anyway, back to the flesh and the body.
The flesh.
I think the objectification question to me is
that.
So important here. So it'd be like, at first, you got to approach this book and you're like, okay, yeah, we have phones, we have technology. We can't do anything about it. Apple was created and now we're all slaves.
There's a great quote at the very beginning of the book that we need to read.
Okay, read it.
It caught my attention because it's
Jim Carrey quote.
Who doesn't love Jim Carrey, first of all? I feel like I don't know him personally, but I know that's a shocker.
Yeah, I thought you guys would be.
But he has like such good control of his body. You know, like his facial expressions. I feel like he knows every single muscle in his face better than any other human.
Certainly in his early acting career, he was a fully embodied actor.
Yeah. Okay, anyway. Yeah. So the quote is, in the near future, we'll only be able to communicate through devices. Actual human contact will be outlawed by the Apple iCourt. And I love that.
It is a little scary.
It's scary. And I'm not like a... Oh, the end is coming. We're only going to text each other because I actually do love texting.
Yeah.
But it makes me think, like, what is it about, why is it that I'm so drawn to text rather than call or to visit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And why is it that when my family's around me, I'm so inclined to pick up my phone and just text whatever pops into my head and then wonder why I don't remember what my husband was talking about at dinner? seriously. Yeah.
Or to like watch TV and be texting at the same time, like a double screen action going on, right? Or we got our phones on the table every moment that we're in a meeting, or we're looking at them when our kids are playing at the playground. We're all looking at our phones. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really, we're all guilty of it. So it's not like I'm sitting here saying I'm on the moral high ground with my iPhone here and all my Apple devices. Like, seriously, feel like a slave to them.
Yeah.
But also love the products. Like, don't know what to do because they're so amazing. So
exactly.
I think the thing that we have to reckon with is, okay, so it's all great and wonderful, right? Lots of innovations are the railroad, industrial revolutions, all sorts of innovations are wonderful. The cotton gin. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, the printing press, but they all also have major moral and human implications to them.
Right.
And we have not reckoned with or figured out the human implications of the technology because it's moving so fast.
That's right. One thing that Brené Brown says about that in her leadership book that I know we're both reading, or you finished, I'm in the middle of.
I'm done.
Is she talks about how you should see the snarky look on his face. Ben finishes every book about 3 weeks before I do.
No, that's not true.
But she talks about how the impulse, the technological impulse, should be calling humans into their humanness instead of making us become more computer-like. And so she talks about like leading in vulnerability and kind of understanding who we are and what our feelings mean. Those are our assets that we bring to the workplace.
Right.
But instead, we're trying to figure out how to make ourselves more perfect and more machine-like and more predictable instead of leaning
more productive
in
and more efficient.
More productive and more efficient.
But the problem is that human beings don't usually reach for tools that help them be better in their relationships. Mm-hmm. They usually reach for tools that help them distance themselves from others,
right,
and create the kind of emotional boundaries that they want to survive or to isolate or to numb or to fall into certain kinds of avoidance, denial, right? So we that's the problem with technology. It's not benign. You can't just create something and say – it's like the old story of Frankenstein, Mary Shelley. You know, just because you create something doesn't mean it's good. It can be awful.
Yeah.
You know, like something – it can harm the world. Just because you create it doesn't mean we should use it.
Right.
That's where like all progress isn't all good.
So this is making me think like we were about to jump into objectification and we want to spend some time there, I know. But even when we were brainstorming what to pull out from these chapters, we didn't talk about self-objectification. And I think like our tendency to refuse our humanness is one version of self-objectification.
Right.
Like we create these caricatures of ourselves. Like I am productive, I am successful, I am smart, I am powerful, you know, I can do this.
Yeah.
And then we forget to realize, oh, I'm also human.
Right.
Like that's going to hurt my feelings. I'm going to fail. I'm going to miss that deadline. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to forget about that meeting.
Right.
And we forget. And so we hold, like, it's almost like we have a portrait of ourselves that we show in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And then a portrait of ourselves that we show on our social media profiles.
Right.
And anything less is just like we can't even let ourselves be less than that. More than that, to be human.
Exactly. I think that is so important because that gets right into what Frost calls the basically links to the reasons we got to where we are, which is this sort of I have to kind of blame some of this on the Enlightenment here because it's this sort of desire for radical individual freedom and freedom from everything, freedom from government, freedom from relationship, freedom from marriage, freedom from home, freedom from and even freedom from the limitations of bodily existence.
Right.
And so what happens is it turns out as freedom runs rampant and it's not freedom for life or humanity, it's just freedom arbitrarily for all things, freedom from humanity, right? Yeah. We want to be other than human in some way. We get to this place where we no longer can see limitation as freedom.
Right.
Because limitation is also freedom. And think about how freeing it is to be able to say, you know what? I'm just not going to make it to that meeting today.
Yeah.
I don't have what it takes.
Yeah.
I'm tired. You know, think about how freeing that is if you could say that without your boss getting mad or whatever, right?
Yeah.
You can just say, like, I don't have anything. I don't have anything for you.
Yeah.
But what we want to do is live as if we're not human. Mm-hmm. People are still chasing this, like, perfect cure so that they can live forever.
Yeah.
People are avoiding sleep with medications, with pills, and they're going crazy and going insane. Mm-hmm. People are trying to escape human existence through drugs and medications and to transcend this human experience in some way. all pretending we don't have limits of time and place and space, mm-hmm. that we are somehow bigger than that, bigger than God, right? And we don't need sleep. God even rested. We don't need to rest,
right.
You know? And that lack of seeing, it's not liberation, right? Because it's actually freedom for a new kind of slavery. Look at us all. Look at how I was describing Apple.
Right.
I have radical freedom. I could choose whatever phone I want, and yet I never choose a Sprint phone, yeah. right, or a Samsung.
I don't even look at them.
I don't even think about them.
No.
Never, right?
Yeah.
I see the commercials, and I'm like, oh, that must be somebody else's life. You know, wouldn't that be nice to have a Samsung 8, you know, 9? You know, it's like we become slaves to the products that work for us. We become, and we find ourselves enslaved because of our pursuit of freedom.
Yeah.
It's the cereal box. So you're like, you're going to the cereal aisle and there's so many choices that you like fall on the floor and weep. I can't make a choice.
Okay, I've never done that.
That's like a 4-year-old child. It's like, which one do you want? I don't know. I can't make a choice. Because there's too many choices, you know?
That's
or you
funny.
Choose one and you have to stick with it for the rest of your life, you know? I think this idea that we can escape our bodies and escape our humanness mm-hmm. is what leads to this sort of technological slavery.
Yeah. Well, I think it's ironic, too, that we're having the conversation around freedom and commitment, really, or freedom and covenant, when we're part of a religious tradition that's born out of covenant.
Yeah.
And like, you know, so I'm thinking about the Jewish tradition and the 613, you know, laws that you're supposed to abide by and how enfleshed those laws are. But I'm also thinking about a covenant, like a marriage, lifelong partnership covenant and how... And just kind of the tension between freedom and constraint that kind of offers to all of us. And I would just speak out of my own experience that like there's a lot of freedom that grows out of knowing that the partner I chose is always there for me.
Yeah.
Right. But then at the same time, there is a rejection of like irresponsible freedom to like go out into the world and do whatever I want with whoever
I
want.
Anyone who's dated recently knows that world is not free. I mean, like, I'll never forget, like...
It's not safe.
It's not safe. It's not free. Like, trying to get dressed for a club. There's no way to go to a club looking like yourself. No. If you do that, you're just never going to meet anyone. So don't go to a club looking like yourself. So you have to pretend to be someone else. That's not freedom.
Yeah.
You're already being disingenuous. You get there. You're trying to meet someone else who's pretending to not be themselves. And then so you guys can go off and be yourselves together.
And you
it's
can't
crazy.
Tell them who you really are until day four.
Yeah, right. It's like when I was telling you about... telling people I was the executive director of a nonprofit while I was dating because I didn't want them to find out that I was a pastor. Because they can't handle it.
They
it's too much information.
Them.
That's the thing. Reality, this whole excarnate phenomenon is part of why people just can't deal with reality anymore.
Yep.
On the one hand, they have the worst images in human history coming to them in a flash of a second. Kids being tear gassed last night, right? On the border. All sorts of images from Yemen. Children starving. You know, all over the world, they're seeing images, people getting shot, shootings, on their feeds all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they're seeing it, and you would think, oh, that's going to make everybody feel more empathetic. Nope.
No.
It's creating numbing.
Yep.
They're just numbing, and they're becoming desensitized to all the violence mm-hmm. and all that they're seeing constantly, and are sort of distancing themselves from humanity.
Mm-hmm.
They're becoming less human,
mm-hmm.
right? We can't handle the reality that is happening before. We don't want to hear reality at all.
Right.
We just want an illusion.
Right.
Give us an escape.
And that's why rediscovering and recovering ancient acts of embodied faith are so important.
Mm.
Like we've been thinking a lot about what does pilgrimage mean and what is the role of pilgrimage in the life of the church. And
absolutely.
It's been brought back in through the Awakening series. But to put our bodies outside of a detention center and to see where people who have not been convicted of criminal offense, but simply have a civil violation of crossing a border are being held by a corporation and the condition, you know, to see their daughters coming out, having just visited their fathers.
Now, that's something you can't experience by looking at an article.
No, it's not. And it evokes a different kind of response.
Yep.
And so it challenges me to say, okay, faith leader, how are you going, you know, how do you take these experiences and bring them back to groups of people who can't make their bodies go to those places?
Well, just like I was sort of saying yesterday about Elizabeth being pregnant and how obvious it was in a sermon, I just think as an Advent sermon, I just think when people came back from the pilgrimage and spoke about their experiences, mm-hmm. it was obvious the difference the body makes.
Yeah.
We don't have to talk about it anymore.
Right.
We just have to do it. We can show you.
Yep.
I can say, look at this person. Where were they at before they went on this?
Mm-hmm.
Now look at what they're hearing now.
Mm-hmm.
Their body was there. That's the only difference.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They've read lots of articles. They're really smart people. It's not that they're not brilliant. Right. It's that their bodies weren't at Stewart.
Right.
Their bodies weren't in York. Their bodies weren't over across town at the court. Right. It's like just being there physically is a new, like you keep saying, is a different kind of learning.
It's a different kind of learning. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think, and that may be the kind of learning that we need to escape the consequences. What I really was going to go to when we started talking about, okay, technology is changing so rapidly. How do we keep up? There are moral implications. There are faith implications. There are spiritual implications. And this is where you see finally now Silicon Valley's coming around to say, hey, yeah, we're realizing your kids should not be on a device for that many hours a day.
Yeah.
We're finally starting to hear that coming out of the very people making the devices. Mm-hmm. By the way, if the people making something are telling you that their products might be harmful, trust them immediately. It's like when the cigarette companies had to put a warning. Yeah. Right? Trust them that their product is dangerous.
Yeah.
Don't keep thinking that your phone is just a friendly device in your pocket.
Yeah.
It's not benign. It's dangerous. It needs limitation. The same is true of what just general excarnate, disembodied thinking, attitudes, culture does with how we relate to one another as human beings. And so I want to get into this objectification thing. There's this great quote where he says that disembodying others causes us to treat people as either objects or ideas. And God, we've talked about objectification on this podcast before.
A little bit.
As someone objectified regularly, Christy, can you talk about that?
Well, first of all, my name's not Christy.
I said Christy.
You know, one example comes to mind immediately, and that's a story about. It's a hypothetical question, right? An ideological question that's probably pedagogical in nature, but still it haunts me. It literally keeps me awake some nights when I think about it. So the dilemma is if a person – I'm just going to just come out and say it. If a male individual masturbates thinking about a female individual but never says anything to her, approaches her, or even makes her aware that this is happening – is a male committing sexual violence against her? And my answer is unflinchingly yes, because the woman has been belittled and reduced to an idea of a woman.
Yeah.
And not even allowed to know about it.
Not real. Yeah.
I mean, it's and the more that that happens in the mind of an individual who is separated from the object of his objectification, or I could even say her objectification, because I'm not going to pretend like women don't objectify.
Yeah.
The less connected to an embodied relationship they both become, really. But it's horrifying to me that we have to ask the question. Like, it seems like such an obvious answer to me.
Right.
But it's a terrifying example of the disembodiment of our society.
Well, first of all, most people are not even going to ask the question, so that's already we're talking about tough issues here, folks. So
Only the toughest issues on this podcast.
But and also, I would say that most people, particularly men, I would have to say in this category, men mostly would disagree with your conclusion vehemently.
Yeah.
About whether there was what the morality of their act is. And they would probably use the sort of slippery slope, like, well, would it have been better if I told you? Would it have been better? I mean, you're not advocating.
You didn't think it.
Right. I mean, because you're not advocating people to come to tell them.
Right.
Right. So, and I mean, be clear, neither am I. I think because this whole conversation was stimulated again recently in sort of the public sphere by Nadia Boltz-Weber. Did you read about this? Where
No.
She said that there is no shame in consuming ethically sourced pornography.
I did see that.
And she got a lot of heat from the evangelical community for that, who, by the way, are in bed with Disney, who owns a lot of the porn companies. So that's all hypocritical. Anyway, but the idea that there is such a thing as ethically sourced pornography and that it might be morally – or no shame, no moral shame in consuming that or participating in that is a challenging conversation for her to bring up, right, in a world where we're trying to struggle. Nobody even wants to talk about the problem of pornography or sex addiction and relationship to pornography at all. Certainly not in the church and definitely not in society. Nobody's talking about it. I don't know anybody. I mean, maybe a few evangelicals are writing books called Every Man's Battle and Every Woman's Battle. Different battles, by the way.
Can't wait to read those.
Please don't read those books. That's another disclaimer. But they are about that topic. So there's very few people, and they're not dealing with it in helpful ways. So I guess the question for me, though, is like, where does moral responsibility begin, right?
Yeah.
And what is the way around it? How do you deal with it? How do you process it?
A couple of things from the Bible are coming to mind.
Oh, good, yeah.
Interesting, right? The first
interesting
is,
for you, yeah.
Yeah. Hush. I love the Bible.
I know you do.
Especially Jesus, mm-hmm. in case you were wondering. But these actually are both examples from Jesus. So when Jesus says, whoever has committed adultery in the mind, right? Mm. It's not adultery, it's anger.
Yeah. Well, no, he says if you are angry, you've already committed
murder. That's it.
And if you lust, you've already committed adultery.
That's it. Thank you. See, Ben reads the Bible. So that came to mind.
I did once. Yeah.
And I've forgotten the others. No, the others are like just to me, the answer when the question is like, where is the moral responsibility?
Yeah.
Is always to rehumanize.
Mm-hmm.
If you wouldn't do it in the flesh, mm-hmm. don't do it in the mind.
Yeah.
If there is something like that, I mean, that's it. I mean, and you think about the ministry of Jesus, who is always taking a leper, air mm-hmm. quotes, a tax collector, a Pharisee, a sinner,
yeah.
a woman, and centralizing that human in the body. Jesus is not going out throughout Galilee and preaching sermons on, you know, equal yeah. rights for women.
He does preach one sermon.
Well,
yeah, but that's not all he does.
And we should preach those sermons. But more importantly, Jesus is actively, constantly putting his body
yeah.
and taking it out of the center and grabbing someone on the margin in their body and bringing
right.
them into the center as a human, like as a whole human.
Right. And sometimes coming in and disrupting other bodies that are a little too comfortable, like say in the temple or other places like that. So he's engaging bodies all over.
Right.
And we're not always happy with how he's engaging those bodies, and the bodies that he chooses to treat in different ways were usually almost always countercultural.
Yep.
But So I think you're right. Like Jesus lives a very embodied existence, so embodied that he's willing to allow himself to be portrayed as a tax collector and prostitute.
Mm. Yeah.
In order to continue to be so embodied. I mean, imagine, you know, somebody in your life being so embodied that they're being accused of being, you know, taking advantage of prostitutes and yet at the same time claiming to be a holy person.
Mm.
That's pretty hard.
Yeah.
And so that's a risk of embodiment that Jesus is willing to take over and over and over again in order to be with people.
Yeah.
You know, at the same time, I think one of the reasons we ask for confession, one of the ways we pray for confession for the things that we've done and left undone, the things that we've thought, the inclinations of our hearts, our desires,
mm-hmm.
is because there are things that we have that are sinful that we can't control.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people would say, well, if it's just natural, it must not be sinful.
Right.
You know, which is completely
that's
untrue.
That's not true.
I
right.
naturally want lots of money and would be happy to kill you and take it. That's natural. You know, there's this sort of natural law kind of moral idea that, you know, human beings are basically like, you know, self-preservation. And for self-preservation, they're usually going to do the right thing. And it undergirds a lot of Catholic moral teaching and moral theology. But in the reality, we're animals.
Mm-hmm.
And we will do what's necessary to survive. And it's
right.
social Darwinism. It's it's murder, you know. And we have – look at the wars in the 21st century. You know, there's not like, you know, if we just got together, our better natures would be – you know, no, we couldn't kill each other.
Yeah.
And so I think this idea that somehow if it's just natural, if it's a natural inclination we have, then it must be benign or neutral and not have moral things. No, constantly we're thinking up things that we shouldn't be thinking.
Right.
That's why we repent every day.
Right. And that's why covenant is mm-hmm. central to the Jewish faith and to the Christian faith.
Right. And in communal, embodied
right.
communal existence
right.
and rules and practices for living in embodied communal existence are so critical
mm-hmm.
for us as we – which sort of leads to this question about belonging
yep.
that comes through here. I think that's – or at least this is what Frost argues is – where the rubber hits the road, because there is this deep, deep desire for belonging
mm-hmm.
that is simply increasing in our culture because technology, because we are further and further separated by each other. And it's sort of a vicious cycle because we're further and further separated for each other by the very technology that's supposed to be getting us
that's
into
right.
more deeper relationship with each other.
Mm-hmm.
like everybody keeps saying, well, you know, so Facebook is just a tool for connecting. Mm-hmm. No, it's also a tool for toppling governments and allowing Russians to take over the earth. You know, it's a tool for multiple things. It's not just for you to talk to your grandma. You know, it's doing more in the world than you imagine it's doing.
Yeah.
So
it's like a double-edged sword.
Yeah, like the gospel.
Just saying.
And so I think we have to be attentive to that, that on the one hand, technology keeps telling us this will help your life. It'll right. help you be more productive, efficient. But in its best sense, it's a tool for deeper human connection.
Right. Well, and I mean, Frost's argument just amplifies, I think, what we read with Brené last Lent, right. where there's a trend towards a decreasing sense of belonging. Mm. And yet we live in a world with more tools than ever to help us connect.
Right.
So what's going
on? So back
on?
To that thing you were saying that Brené says that the tools should be helping us become more human.
That's right.
And not helping us become more like computers.
Exactly. And yet the inverse is happening.
And the inverse is happening. And so in fact, what's taking place is we never belong. We mm-hmm. feel like we never belong. And we feel like even when there are places that we should belong to, we're not really belonging mm-hmm. to them. I just think about this example that he uses of the movie Up in the mm-hmm. Air
yep.
and George Clooney's character mm-hmm. in Up in the Air, who is, you know, flying all over the country,
yeah.
letting people go and firing them. If you haven't seen the movie, it's an existential,
incredible.
Amazing existential movie. Yeah. And so he has these like warped philosophies about how if he just keeps moving, what's this great quote here? The slower we move, the faster we die. Make no mistake. Moving is living. This is like the voiceover
yeah,
at the beginning of the
is.
Movie.
Yeah.
Some animals were meant to carry each other, to live symbiotically over a lifetime. Yeah, humans, but... And then he says, star-crossed lovers, monogamous swans. We are not swans. We are sharks.
Yeah.
No, you're a swan. You're a swan, buddy. You're not a shark. You're a yeah. human being. You're an advanced mammal. You
right.
were meant to carry one another over a lifetime. That's exactly what you were to create. So this whole setup, the beauty of that movie is they make his life seem so glamorous.
They do.
While at the same time so sad.
Yeah.
You know, he's
yeah.
lonely. He's divorced. He has no family. He's meeting with this girl who's also like cheating on her husband,
yeah.
you know, and then she chooses family over him in the end.
And he's alone.
And he's all alone. Yeah. He has no one.
Well, he has all those air miles.
I know.
Right?
Like the
that's
one,
like his whole life is spent trying to get to this one class.
That's his
of air
goal
miles.
Is just to have the most air miles.
Yeah. And again, like the point, like if you have a lot of air miles, great. That's an opportunity for connection.
Right.
But if you spend it's the means, not the end, right?
Right.
But if you flip those things
yeah.
and you spend your whole life seeking the means,
that's right.
you never experience the end.
He's never gotten where he wanted. Remember, he has this conversation with the guy at the end. He gets to have a conversation with the pilot, and it just doesn't go the way he wants. He's like, the guy's like, well, what did you use all these miles for?
Yeah.
And he's like, well, you know, I worked, you know, and the guy's like, do something else with yeah. your life, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, what if you used all those miles to, like, visit people or to do some good in the world or to create a nonprofit organization and travel all over the universe?
Yeah.
You know, that's one thing, but, like...
Or if you had people you loved that you could share them with and, like, you could all go on a vacation.
Right. Or travel somewhere. But it's not created... It didn't create for him this connection
right.
of more belonging. It actually created further and further alienation for mm-hmm. him from other human beings, from himself. He didn't even know who he was at the end.
Mm-hmm.
When he realizes he's achieved his goal, he has nothing else to do, and he has nobody
that's right.
in his life. He doesn't
right.
belong anywhere to anything.
Right. So, you know, for me, as I think about that, and I think about what Frost is trying to say in the book, and I hold that in tension with the season of Advent, which is literally about becoming enfleshed, like incarnate. It's a time when we remember that God chose to put on human skin
yeah.
and to live in the world as a human. I start thinking about the challenges and how am I going to take this information and incorporate it into my spiritual practice for the season.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about pilgrimage, I realized like the challenge from the book is kind of like a pilgrimage N-word.
Yeah.
It's a journey into our own body.
Yeah.
It's putting our body in places,
mm-hmm.
right? So we came up with a list of things that you may want to do during the season of Advent and that we're going to do.
Yeah.
And so we just want to go through those and then you know, send you on your way to do your embodied.
Exactly. I think
practice.
First of all, it's probably the time to do a technology audit of your life. Let's start there and
that's
just check in with like, how many hours are you spending watching television? How many times a day do you pick up your phone and look at it? How many times a day are you checking your email?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what are you, how much Facebook and social media are you consuming?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many, all you really have to do is count how many hours you're reading or not doing it, maybe it'd be a better place to start. That's what I probably need. I'll start there. I'll start like, how many hours am I reading and doing something other than looking at a device?
Yeah. And Apple makes it easy because they tell you how your screen time's going.
Right.
Like every week you'll get a report if it's up or down from the week before. I don't know if you get that. I get that on my
phone. You get a little report.
Yep. Okay. So that's what you're going to do. I'm going to do, I'm going to try to be present with the people who I'm with. So when I'm having lots of in-person conversations right now.
Yeah.
And to not be distracted by the alerts that are popping up on my phone. And when I'm at dinner with family, just being present in every space that I'm in.
I wish you were more present right now.
I know. I got two screens up right now.
Yeah. And I think there's other things we can do as well, like body practices, being more attentive and intentional about our eating, our exercise, our sleeping and rest, and also our labor, our work, our yoga, walking, other exercise that we're doing, you know, being more intentional about that and being really present in it. Maybe do a run without the earbuds.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, just feel the air and listen to the sounds.
Yeah.
You know, take a walk without them.
Mm-hmm.
Don't just listen to music. You know, walk your dogs at night. It's darker now. Pay more attention to the darkness, the cold.
It's also safer if you pay attention when you walk or run at night.
Yeah, exactly. Take those earbuds.
You never know when a Prius is coming.
Or also, any hybrid car, yes, exactly.
Also, the one that that you said, I don't want to take credit for it, but to think about objectification, right? And to reduce the temptation or resist the temptation to reduce others to like their caricature. Of who you think that they are, you know, after we define someone, and to deny them kind of the complexity of what it means to be human.
That's good. That's good.
I mean, you came up with it, so.
Well, actually, that's not why I was saying it was good. I think the way you put it is what was making it good. No, I think when we're reading, also, we can pay attention to the ways bodies are present in the literature. So both in biblical texts, but also in just all the things we're reading and consuming. What are people doing with their bodies?
Yeah. Well, that's quite a list.
It is.
All right. Happy Advent.
Have a good one.